Isaiah 45 is our reading tonight. Just a few verses, verses 22 to 25. Turn to me and be saved, all the ends of the earth, for I am God and there is no other. By myself I have sworn, from my mouth has gone out in righteousness a word that shall not return. To me every knee shall bow, every tongue shall swear allegiance. Only in the Lord, it shall be said of me, are righteousness and strength. To him shall come and be ashamed all who were incensed against him. In the Lord all the offspring of Israel shall be justified and shall glory.
As you're aware, we're using as our guide this autumn the Day One books, which point us to our rich Christian heritage. And one of the books in the series is on Charles Haddon Spurgeon. And it's good that we have the author of that book tonight with us, Clive Anderson. He's the pastor of Butts Church in Alton, and previously he was a pastor at church in London too. So we welcome him tonight, and we look forward to hearing more of the life and work of Charles Spurgeon.
Now, once a long time ago, so long ago I can't remember it, I was born in a place called Dorset. And when I was very young, I was dragged up to South London, and I lived in a place called West Dulwich. Appropriately, the name of the road was Clive Road. I thought, this is a sign of things to come, or maybe not. And then we moved to West Norwood. My parents, or my mother in particular, became caretaker of what was a very famous church called Lansdowne Evangelical Free Church in West Norwood. People like T.H. Bendor Samuel and Derek Prime were pastors there. My father was Derek Prime's first Christian friend after his conversion, so we've known the Primes through thick and thin for many long years. And just over the way from where we were is the cemetery where Spurgeon is buried, along with many other luminaries. Mrs. Beaton is buried there. She was only 29 when she died. She was as thin as a rake. It's quite surprising. If you've got her cookbook, you imagine that she's out here. Gordon Mantell, who discovered the first dinosaur bone down in Maidstone, the thumb bone, is buried there. And they reckon there's around about 10,000 of Spurgeon's members buried round about him. So on the day of resurrection, if any of us are there, it's going to be quite a sight, isn't it? But it's lovely that I've been invited to come here. Because I was in such a privileged position in the church, there being so close, we often used to take people on guided tours round. And as my mother was caretaker, she often provided refreshments for visiting speakers, and I was privileged to get to know Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones very well on his annual visit. He signed every copy of his book that came out, that I forced upon him, and he was very gracious to us as a family when my brother was killed back in 1976, and it was quite remarkable, his pastoral skills. But not just for that, but Lloyd-Jones and Spurgeon are my great heroes, and I'm here this evening because of an accident. John Roberts, who was the director of Day One, was in Bedford one day, and the person he was with said, "Do you know anything about John Bunyan?" And he said, "No," and he showed him all the sites, and he said, "I think this would make a lovely travel guide." So the travel guide on Bunyan came out and has been very popular. And then they decided to get together other authors to do other people and situations and countries and buildings. They wanted Ian Murray to do Spurgeon. Ian Murray said he was unable to fulfill it at that time. So a friend of mine, I think he's a friend of mine, suggested that I do it. And so Day One drew the short straw in every way, okay, in having me. But there we go. And since then, because I'm great friends with the editor, Brian Edwards, I am joint author with him of the book around the British Museum, and we lead many tours around there. Also in this series, I've done Israel with Paul Williams, and with my wife, I've done one on Egypt. And the Egypt one's very useful if you no longer have one or want an additional one, because you just open the pages and find mummy. So there we are. I think this man is quite remarkable. I must be careful not to put him on a pedestal, but Spurgeon is almost unique in my experience because of all the different things he was involved in. Now, there are many ways to look at the life of Spurgeon. I've just read two books that have just come out. I'm not going to remember them, so I wrote them down. One is on the gospel focus of Spurgeon by Stephen Lawson in the United States of America. And the other one is Exploring CHS is Key to Ministerial Success by Bob Penharrow, who's in Ontario. And so I thought, well, what line can I take? And I think I'm right in saying that Spurgeon's ministry is a ministry of revival because of what happened. Now, Brian Edwards, who I've mentioned earlier, has written extensively on revival, and he gives a definition here which I like. A true Holy Spirit revival is a remarkable increase in the spiritual life of a large number of God's people. So it's the Holy Spirit first and then acting upon God's people, accompanied by an awesome awareness of the presence of God. And you certainly get that in the meetings of the tabernacle that Spurgeon pastored for so long. There is an intensity of prayer and praise, a deep conviction of sin with a passionate longing for holiness, and unusual effectiveness in evangelism leading to the salvation of many unbelievers. And that is what I'm going to consider this evening as we look at him. There's so many facets to this fellow. What is really surprising is how young he was when he died. He was 57 years of age. He was born on the 19th of June, 1834, 17 years before the hypodermic syringe was invented. So when he was born, medical care was very basic, and he died on the 31st of January, 1892. He was born just a little after Carey died. Now, I know that history is very complex, and to try and reduce it to sound bites is very difficult. But if you know anything about church history, we were extremely blessed by a number of people, including George Whitfield, during what's known as the 18th century revival, he and John Wesley and so many others. But there came a time of great dearth. Whitfield died in 1770. Spurgeon was born in 1834. And you can see this great dearth of religion and of godliness that entered into this land of ours. And I put it down in large measure, and it's not total, but in large measure to Napoleon Bonaparte. Now, where I live in Alton, we have quite a number of famous people who live nearby, like Alan Titchmarsh, you may have heard of him, and some others. But particularly, we have Jane Austen. We have her house at Chawton. And if you go there, there's a lovely little table. It's very small, and on it, she wrote Pride and Prejudice. And you see this little table there, and if you read Pride and Prejudice as an example of Austen's work, you find that the vicar, the gentleman that she describes there, the minister of religion, is weak and washy, he's avarice, he's not a nice man at all. He's one of those men that you don't want to shake their hands. It's like a bit of wet fish, you know, and it's horrible. And that is how, generally speaking, Christianity and Christian ministers were portrayed. And it's because of Bonaparte. He had sprung on the scene, and he was determined to conquer the world. Even though he'd been defeated at the Battle of the Nile, he still had designs on the whole world. And he actually said that he wanted to rewrite the Quran, rewrite the Quran to his own purpose. And no doubt in my mind, what he wanted to do was make himself the central figure in the Quran, because he wanted to take it with him into India as he conquered in India. So he had in his own mind visions of being Alexander the Great and Muhammad combined. And he was going to take over the known world. And you can check it for yourselves. If he wasn't defeated in June 1815 at the Battle of Waterloo, I think we may have well been speaking French tonight. It really was one of those monumental moments of history when he was defeated. And so by the time Spurgeon came on the scene, many Christians were weak-willed, namby-pamby, and didn't know what they believed. And he came on like a whirlwind, and he changed society. Here's his parents. I'm sorry they're not better pictures than that, They are pretty old. His father is John Spurgeon. His mother is Eliza Spurgeon, née Jarvis. And if you're interested at all, I'll give a little detail of where they came from in the different parts of Essex. And his father, John, worked in a coal yard. He was clerk in a coal yard, but he also was part-time minister of a congregational church. This is where Spurgeon was born. It's a little village called Kelvedon in Essex. There is a bunker there. It's quite a famous one now that was built during the Cold War. You can go and visit it and go down at Kelvedon Hatch. But also in this village prior to this, there was a lot of movement with Puritans and others. People like William Byrd and Thomas Tallis, who were great composers, but were also Roman Catholic, they came down to Kelvedon, and there's what used to be known as a safe house with a priest hole in it and everything that they used to go and stay in. But this little house on the main road there, it's a private house, so they don't appreciate people knocking on the door saying, can we see X marks the spot where Spurgeon was born? And for ladies who seem to be more interested in this than men, I don't know his fighting weight at birth, nor do I know the time of day, nor do I know if he had any hair or teeth or anything like that. But isn't it interesting what you see there? It calls him Baptist preacher and philanthropist. He is the prince of preachers, but there's so much more to him. When he was 18 months old, his parents couldn't afford him. What do you do with a child if you can't afford them? Ask the stork to come back again? No. We send them off to the grandparents. And so he went off to live with his grandparents in a place called Stambourne. Now, this is one of those strange villages that we have in the south of England. But when you go there, you enter in from the bottom there up the main road. So you've got the big church and obviously the pub. And you're looking for where the Spurgeons used to be. And it's difficult to find. And we drove round and round. And then we came back to this sign and we thought, well, I wonder if that little place up there that's depicted just next to the shield. And so we drove down there and we found what we were looking for. The little church at Stambourne where his grandfather James ministered for many long years. He was known as a great preacher. People would say they would walk miles to hear a Spurgeon. There's not many of you here as old as I am. There used to be a television program called All Gas and Gaiters. And they used to dress in the old clerical garb with the knee breeches and everything. Well, that's what Grandpa dressed like. And he was there with his silk stockings on and everything. But he was a fantastic preacher. But he realized over the years that his son had eclipsed him with this gift. Although there was one priceless meeting, I'd love to have been there, where Charles was due to preach and he was late, so his granddad started preaching. Halfway through, Charles came in and granddad said, "This is the text, I've explained this and this, it's your turn now." And so Charles came to the front, he did the second point, and then grandpa said, "Oh, I know about this," and came up and took over, preached the next bit of the sermon, and then handed over the conclusion to his grandson. It must have been a magnificent sight, but there we are. This is the church, this black and white at the top there, or sepia colour, that was around in Spurgeon's day. Just before this time, that they've removed them now, they used to have great doors in the side of the church where people could back their carriages in. So if you came to church in a carriage with horses on, you used to back it in so that you could be in church. This is for the gentry, so they could stay in the carriage during the act of worship, because they didn't want to smell the riffraff who are around and about them. There's nothing like good Christian fellowship, is there? And that was nothing like good Christian fellowship. But it's a shame we can't see that now. Here is a picture of it today. It's a very small little building. And James's grave is nearby in a very poor state of preservation. But being there was a wonderful providential move, an act of God, because Spurgeon learnt so much. Here's the modern manse. The old manse is long gone. And it was in the old manse that Spurgeon found great friendship with his Auntie Anne. She was 17 years of age. Ladies, please be encouraged. Through Spurgeon's life, women played such an important part in his spiritual development. Never think that maybe you're never at the front, that you don't have a part to play. You have a crucial part to play. His Sunday school teachers and others, even a cook in one of the places he was at. She was a great influence on him. Indeed, he said of that cook that she was the greatest theologian he'd ever met. And it was here that he lived. Now, prior to this time, there had been a window tax. Parliament, in their wisdom, decided to tax windows, and so people would brick them up or block them off. And right at the top of the old manse, there was one of these staircases that went up to a room. What was in the room? He often stood there and looked, but it's a bit dark with all the windows blocked off. Eventually, his boyish enthusiasm took over, so he climbed up, opened the door. It was really dark inside, walked in and tripped over two great books. Went flat on his conch. And he turned round and picked them up, and the first one was The Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan. It became his favourite book of all time. He read it through, both parts one and parts two, over 100 times in his lifetime. And you'll see many references in his sermons and other things to The Pilgrim's Progress. The other one was Fox's Book of Martyrs. I think some of you may have been here when the excellent Andrew Atherston was here telling you something about the martyrs. And Spurgeon then could relate to it because many of his forebears had been martyrs. Certainly on his father's side, they had come over from the Netherlands, Holland. They were Dutch. And back in 1577, the wicked Duke of Alva had gone there to crush Protestantism. And he boasted, "I have sent 17,000 people to the stake." What an awful thing for the Day of Judgment awaits that man. And so these Huguenots, it's a French nickname for Protestant, came over, and they were Spurgeon's forebears. And so looking through Fox's Book of Martyrs, he was thinking to himself, wow, this is astonishing. And he was forever saying, "I'm blessed that I've come not from royalty, but from God's people who royally shed their blood for the cause." Well, he stayed there. Eventually, he went back. And after a short time, he was sent down with his brother to St. Augustine's in Maidstone. Now, my little book is unique in many ways. Not least that although you've got the black and white, the sepia print there, this is the first time you will have ever seen a photo, unless you've been to Maidstone, of what it looks like today. It doesn't appear in any other book. I'm astonished that no one's taken the trouble to go down there and have a look. But there you go. And here, David Walker, his uncle, was one of the schoolmasters. He taught mathematics, by the way. And you'll be pleased to know about this young man, that Spurgeon became so proficient in mathematics that if his uncle made a mistake at the front, he would point it out to him. "Excuse me!" And his uncle got a bit fed up with this after a while. And Spurgeon very kindly said, "Well, if you make a mistake, it's only right I tell you." And so his uncle then sent him down to the River Medway to do his work. But it was a very important part in his life. And then came a life-changing moment. I'm obviously skipping over many things here. He was deeply disturbed. He was only 15 years of age. He was deeply disturbed about his spiritual condition. Please don't misunderstand me. I don't know how else to phrase this, but the holy grail of Spurgeon's studies is trying to find his diary before he was 16 years of age. There's one out there somewhere. If it still exists, people would give millions for it because it would trace in it his spiritual progress. And he tells us how in his other writings that he was desperate. He heard all these sermons. He'd never heard how to be born again. He'd heard how to live a good life and everything. And he didn't know what to do. Now, his father was the lay minister of this congregational church in Tollesbury. I thought that they hadn't heard that the Second World War had ended. There's no signposts, there's no road names, nothing. And you've got these great hedges and you're driving down and you come to a junction. Which way do you go? Today we have the wonderful sat-navs that never lead us astray. But there we are. But I got there eventually and there's a plaque to his father. Now his father was going one Sunday morning. He was going down there to take a service and he said to his son, "Why don't you come with me?" And Mum pipes up, "He's not coming with you, the 11 miles in the back of that cart. It's snowing." "So, Charles, I'm getting dinner ready, so I'll come to church this evening. You go off to church in Colchester," where he now was. And he tells us that he left home in Hythe Hill and he started walking up through the snow. And it was getting thicker and thicker, and the church he was aiming for was too far away. So he knew there was a little chapel in Artillery Street, and he turned down and he found it on the 6th of January, 1850. There were 15 people in there. The preacher was a thin, wizened man who didn't seem to know what to do. Spurgeon wasn't sure whether or not he wanted to be in this church. It belonged to the Primitive Methodists. And the Primitive Methodists were known for singing so loud that you came out with a headache. And he wasn't up for that. But anyway, he stayed. And inside the chapel today, you'll see this is an extensive thing about his conversion. It is when the man stood up and started speaking and saying to him about the Lord Jesus and taking his text from the reading we had earlier, Isaiah 45, in the Authorized Version, "Look unto me, and be ye saved, all the ends of the earth, for I am God, and there is none else." And this man was trying to explain this text, and he seemed to have got stuck. He didn't know what else to say. And then he saw Spurgeon sat there. And he looked at him, and he said, "Young man, you look very miserable, and you will be miserable unless you look to Jesus. Look now, and you will never be disappointed." And Spurgeon said it was as though the scales went from my eyes. I looked and I could have looked my eyes away because Jesus was now my Saviour and my Lord. They never discovered who that preacher was, although we get some clues, which is quite astonishing. In Spurgeon's college now, they've preserved the pulpit. You'll see it there that was used. They've cleaned it up a bit as well. And with the text at the bottom, "Look to me and be saved." Here is a village nearby called Great Bromley. And many years later, after Spurgeon's death, his father said, he reports it in the Christian Herald, that the preacher actually came from Great Bromley. He was a man who planted cabbages and other things and did some digging. That is the only clue we've got. So if you can find the name of that preacher, could you please let me know? I'll give you a little bit of royalty, maybe a cup of tea or something. I'll get it in the next edition of the book and we make a fortune. But there we are. Now, there's a big problem with the date of Spurgeon's conversion, the 6th of January. People have examined the meteorological records and said there was no snow that day. It was the following week. Now, the problem with that is that he refers to it so often in his sermons, so often in his correspondence, very close to this time, as also years later, that people could have corrected him very easily, not least his family. The reason they say is, well, he obviously, the snow was so bad he couldn't get to Tollesbury with his father. But was it that bad? His father managed to get there. And in the evening, they went up to Lion Court in Colchester, to this church here called now Eld Lane Baptist Church. And it was there that he went in the evening. He was able to walk the 1.5 miles there in the evening. So I think what stopped him going with Dad in the morning was the vagaries of the British weather, but particularly Mum, who didn't want him catching a chill. And I think the 6th of January is the date. He decided then to study the Word of God, and particularly he read through the Church of England Catechism to see what he should do. And he came across one of the questions about baptism. And it talks there about believers being baptized, and he thought he ought to be baptized. And he very naughtily said, I became a Baptist because of the Church of England Catechism. So he was baptized, you'll see here, in the River Lark near Islam. This is now on private farmland, but it's quite something to go there and to see a coach turn up and have 50 Japanese knock on the door saying, can we go and see the site of Spurgeon's baptism? It's very moving, really. And you go there. Now, his mother wasn't pleased. She said to him, she actually wrote a letter and said, my dear Charles, I often prayed to the Lord that you would become a Christian, but I never wanted you to be a Baptist. And Charles wrote back, "Ah, my dear mama, God does more than we ask or imagine." So there we are. And in Islam at the Baptist Church today, you'll find this plaque in memory of the late Reverend W.W. Cantlow, who, while pastor of the church, baptized Spurgeon at Islam. And Spurgeon was fearful. When he got to, I'm not going to go back to the river scene, but when he got there at the river's edge, he said very bravely, "I let two ladies go before me." Eventually my turn came, and there was no excuse now, so he went into the waters, and it's as though the water washed his fears away to the furthest ocean there was. And for that moment, his tongue was loosened. I wonder if he became a little bit of a pest, because he would get tracts and he would pass them to everybody and he'd leave them everywhere and he'd be knocking on your door saying, "Do you know Jesus?" But he was so on fire that God had done something for him. He wanted other people to experience it as well. Many years later, he went back to Islam and he preached, and they served a tea in what was known as the Islam Barn. There's a picture of it there. You can see the red plaque. And again, it's a private house today, so we can't go in it. But he would attract vast crowds wherever he went. After his conversion, he moved to Newmarket and then from there into Cambridge. And here's St. Andrew's Baptist Church in Cambridge. And when he was there, he caused all sorts of problems because he didn't know what to do. He was on fire for God. He wanted to do something. And they said, "Why don't you teach in the Sunday school?" I don't know if it's ever happened to you, if you're new at a church. People often ask you, "Do you fancy teaching in the Sunday school?" Well, for him, yes, he would do it. And he always said, "I was so proud to have the initials SST after my name, rather than MA, BA, or any doctorate." SST, Sunday school teacher. And he was such an effective Sunday school teacher that crowds started coming. Indeed, the minister wasn't too pleased. More people are going to his Sunday school lesson than coming to the church service. And of course, this got noted. And there was one man there called Mr. Vittner. They called him Bishop Vittner because he had a passion for the outlying villages. And he used to send out preachers on a Sunday afternoon. And he could see Spurgeon's talent, but he knew if he went up and said, "Charles, would you go and preach somewhere?" he would blank him. So he's known as the crafty bishop. I don't know if you have crafty bishops today or not, but there we are. And he came up and he said, "Charles, there's a young man going to preach tomorrow. And he could do with someone to accompany him." "Oh, I'll go," says Spurgeon. So they walk out of Cambridge down towards the village of Teversham. And on the way, Spurgeon says to this taller, older brother, "Brother, my prayers are that God will use your message today to this people." Spurgeon said, the young man stood still. "Me? I'm no preacher. I'm not preaching. I'm only here to accompany you." But Spurgeon said, "I'm here to accompany you." "Ah," said the older man, "I know. Why don't there are poor people? Why don't you give them one of your Sunday school talks?" Condescendingly, they can understand that. And so that is what happened. And he ended up in St. Andrew's. And they came across this little old dwelling. And the next picture is a picture inside that's absolutely unique. You won't see it in many places. That's what it looked like. The furniture is a bit more modern than the time Spurgeon was there. But here he is. He came in and he didn't know what to do. And the Lord laid on his heart the text, you'll see it there from 1 Peter 2, "Unto you therefore that believe he is precious." And it says there, it's obviously produced after he died, in which the late Reverend C.H. Spurgeon preached his first sermon in 1850, age 16. That is the room. And if you go there today, although it's a private home now, they've still preserved the site for us. It's opposite the pub. It always intrigues me. Many of these Christian sites are opposite pubs, but there we are. And that is the sign there. And after that, there was no stopping him. He would, after a day's work, walk 6 or 7 miles through the fields without any illumination whatsoever. If he'd fallen down a ditch, he could have drowned or broken his leg or his back. No one would have known where he was. But he had this great enthusiasm for preaching. He went into one village one day, it'd been bucketing with rain, and he turns up there and he bangs on the door. And the woman opens the door. I thought, oh, I didn't think you were coming. We've told everybody, go home. But I've just walked 9 miles, he said. Right. So he said, get the room ready. And he went round all the village, knocking on every door, saying, I'm here, where are you? And he got a full room and preached to them. Such tremendous enthusiasm. One of the villages he preached in was at Water Beach, just north of Cambridge. And they were so impressed with him that they invited this young man at the age of 17 to become their pastor. And the effect he had was incredible. From a few people, in a couple of weeks' time, there were 500. A few weeks after that, there were as many outside the chapel as in the chapel. They were opening the windows. Even though it was midwinter, people were standing there. Sometimes the crowds outside were so great that he'd finish the service inside, then come out and do it all again outside. Revival was taking place. And it's an astonishing thing to consider that this little village that was known as one of the wickedest places in England, that you could go through about 6 months after Spurgeon was there and you wouldn't hear any swearing anymore. God had descended in a mighty way by his Spirit. That is the Baptist Church today. I think I'm right in saying if you go on a Thursday morning, it's 10:30, their coffee morning, they serve the most delicious lemon cake. So I recommend that to you. And here's what he looked like in those far off days. This man on fire for his Saviour. Some thought that he ought to have proper theological training. And the words that you see at the bottom there, seekest thou great things for thyself, seek them not, from Jeremiah, came to him while he's walking over Midsummer Common there in Cambridge. A Dr. Angus from Stepney Bible College, now Regent's College, Oxford, had been alerted to this young man, and so a meeting was set up. Dr. Angus came to Cambridge, to the home of Mr. Macmillan, the grandfather of one of our former prime ministers. And then all of a sudden someone decided, oh, we ought to tell Spurgeon that he's going to meet this man, because no one had. They'd set it all up without him. So Spurgeon turns up. Dr. Angus is there waiting for him. The maid comes, answers the door, and shows Spurgeon into another room. After 2 hours, Spurgeon says, is he here yet? Oh, says the maid, I'm ever so sorry. He was really angry and he was saying unpleasant things about you. He didn't think you were coming. I forgot to introduce the two of you. And so Spurgeon wondered, what is my life about? Do I need theological training? And as he left, those words came to him. He was convinced they were audible, that God had spoken to him. Seekest thou great things for thyself? Seek them not. I know what your life is about. In the travel guide series, you will get, if you ever want to go to these places, maps. So you get the overall map at the top there of Cambridge, and then exploded views going through. And then revival comes to London, the wickedest city on earth. We've seen some atrocious things regarding young people in the past few weeks being said. It was nothing compared to, sadly, what was going on then. Dickens' novels were written about real situations. And Spurgeon was amazed one Sunday at Water Beach. He came to take the service, and lying there on the pulpit was a letter from a church in London. We don't quite do it this way today, but they were inviting him to become their pastor. But they thought they ought to hear him first in London. So he said, you know, I got this information, then I had to take the morning service after that with my mind whirring. Eventually, in December, he comes down into London, and he finds that people are not interested in Christianity, but they're interested in Christmas. Because Charles Dickens, A Christmas Carol, had had a great effect, so there's people going round there with their turkeys, with their Christmas trees and other things. But no one seemed to be interested in Christmas. And near the British Museum, they put him up in a dwelling, and he said, I was appalled when I went into my bedroom. It was no bigger than a cupboard. I couldn't lay down. And the other people in that guest house, they mocked my voice because I was a country bumpkin. They mocked the way I dressed. And when they heard I'd come to London to preach, they said, forget it. We've got the most eloquent preachers in the world here. Their manuscripts are superb. what part of the Greek philosophers are you going to quote tomorrow? And he went to bed dejected. The next day he got up and he walked down early morning, passing all the major sites of Westminster Abbey. He sort of did a bit of a detour because he was so nervous, down past St. Paul's. There was the River Thames on the right. The River Thames at that time was the sewer of London. It stank literally to high heaven. And if anyone was brave enough to draw water off, it had a strange brown colour to it. So if you went to drink it, that is why many people historically used to drink beer, because it was better for their health. But he went down and eventually across Southwark Bridge, and he came through these streets, and this is from the time of Spurgeon, you'll see here. Streets maybe, you can imagine the Artful Dodger, if you know Dickens at all, running through streets like this. He came to New Park Street Chapel on the 18th of December, 1853. This great bastion of Protestantism, where Dr. John Gill and Dr. John Rippon and other such luminaries of the past had ministered. And he came and he went in, and London and the world, I think, were changed dramatically because of what took place next. If you go to try and find the church today, it is no longer in existence. You'll see there, just by the railings, a little road, and you'll see it just here. So in my next slide, it's just down there where the red car is. So the church would have been just behind in there. And they really took to him. So much so, and this was unheard of, so much so that the evening congregation trebled in size. Normally you have three times less the people on a Sunday evening, don't you? But not then, because they'd heard of this incredible young preacher. And New Park Street, it was just a success story under God. And we see that God used Spurgeon's preaching as an aid to revival. Here he is studying. He loved books. He had over 10,000 books in his library. But for him, the main book, and you'll see it here, was his Bible. Here he's annotated the Song of Solomon. And he was someone who was so on fire for God. Here he is in his study with his open Bible. Is a representation of when he lived at a place called Westwood. And so great were the crowds coming that they needed to extend the chapel at New Park Street. So on Sunday evenings, they hired out Exeter Hall in the Strand. Here you'll see a black and white representation. You may just see Spurgeon there preaching to about 8,000 people. If you go down the Strand today, you'll see the picture at the bottom. It's the Strand Palace Hotel. In fact, so great were the crowds that people who were going to church at New Park Street and didn't realise that he wasn't there, the taxi cabs or the hansom cabs were drawing up and saying to them, over the water to Charlie, because he was over there in the Strand. And the clergy of St. Paul's Cathedral and Westminster Abbey looked at what he was doing on a Sunday evening and thought, I don't know, why don't we have evening services? And they're still going to this day because of him. Not many people know that, but you do. A young man came to him and said, I feel a call to preach. Here he is, young Tom Medhurst. And so Spurgeon started his pastor's college. Ian Murray says it's the greatest work he ever did. When he was just 21 years of age, a principal of a pastor's college at 21. And it grew and grew and is still going today. Here's Tom Medhurst a little later. You can see his right arm is leaning near a bust of Spurgeon. I'm sure he's not worshipping, but there he was a few years after. The highlight for him came on the 8th of January, 1856, what the papers called the Royal Wedding of the Year, when Spurgeon was married to Susanna Thompson. Forgive me if you're not cricket lovers, but in South London there's a very famous cricket ground called the Oval. And near there is a road where Susanna Thompson lived. Coincidentally, just round the corner is where Catherine Booth lived, who went on to marry William Booth. So these two ladies would have known each other. It's surprising how these things happen. So they got married, and they went to Paris, and there's the Champs-Élysées, where they went up and down whatever honeymoon couples do when they walk down the Champs-Élysées. The pastor's college was built at the rear, eventually, of the Metropolitan Tabernacle when it was built. And over 900 men went through the college in Spurgeon's lifetime. An astonishing thing. And if you go around South London today, more than North London, you will see all these churches that he planted and that he supplied the first pastors for. And South London still, not so much today, but still bears the mark of Spurgeon in a remarkable way. One of the tutors at the college was David Gracie, and he's buried very near Spurgeon in the cemetery. He was a great scholar. Then came the Indian Mutiny of 1857, when the Indians got fed up with British rule, and there was a lot of bloodshed. And such was the indignation and felt in this country, the government decided to hold a fast day to call the people to prayer. That's a novel idea, someone could suggest to the government today, isn't it? And they invited this young man, this 23-year-old Spurgeon, to be the preacher. And they were going to hold it at the Crystal Palace, this remarkable structure that first had been in Hyde Park, but then was moved to what's known as Upper Sydenham. It was called the Crystal Palace because it so glinted in the sunshine. And it was here that people were to come. And to give you an idea, here is inside, here's Queen Victoria. You might just see her. Look at the height that's there. Queen Victoria is there at one of her Jubilee services, and to have this young man come and preach. And so the fast day service took place on the 7th of October, 1857. Huge crowds came. It's the earliest recorded number of people at a service of worship, the largest number, because they had turnstiles to get people in. So they know almost 24,000 people were there. And there's Spurgeon there in the pulpit. He was able to project his voice so that virtually everybody heard him. What an astonishing thing. I can't think of a modern equivalent of him. Forgive me if this sounds rather secular. But maybe he had a voice a bit like Pavarotti. He certainly had a chest capacity like Pavarotti. And maybe his voice is a bit like Brian Blessed, if you know him. And that booming voice, those Spurgeons were said to be like a bell tinkling pleasantly. He was so exhausted afterwards that he went home and he slept for 3 days. But you can still read that remarkable sermon today where he calls us to repentance, to calls us as a country to turn to God. Another place he went to was the Surrey Gardens Music Hall. One of his deacons said, please, please, please don't hire that. Don't take the Lord's work into the devil's house. Because all sorts of sideshows and things were going on. But he decided to go there and he preached to 10,000 people there over a period of weeks. Sadly, at the first service, a couple of men decided to be mischievous. As Spurgeon had started the service at the back of the hall, they stood up and shouted, "Fire! Fire!" And this caused panic. And about 8 people were trampled to death. Spurgeon continued with the service. He wasn't quite sure what was going on. And then he was told. And it led to deep depression. He went home and his wife said, "He put his head on my lap and he wept like a baby." And I don't think he ever recovered from it. Although the next week he was back there preaching the glorious gospel. He loved to preach in the open air. This is the Crouch Oak at Addleston in Surrey. And you can still see the tree there today. Under that tree, and I've been assured the tree is old enough for this to have happened, John Wycliffe and George Whitfield also preached. So he felt it was a great privilege for him to preach there. It was decided to build the Metropolitan Tabernacle at a place called the Elephant and Castle. This was the design, although the 4 towers were never built because it would have costed too much. It was an astonishing sight. That is the front of it today, the neoclassical sign, where Dr. Peter Masters is the minister. And the front has just survived. It's had a number of fires over the years and was always so bombed in the Second World War. But this is how it looked in Spurgeon's day. There were 3,600 seats. There were side seats that people could perch themselves on, but there was also standing room. So Sunday morning, Sunday evening, for almost 30 years, 6,000 people went to the tabernacle to listen to him. The services may not have been quite like the ones you're used to, I don't know. Before the service, people were there. They would be peeling their oranges or reading the Times or doing whatever until Spurgeon appeared and a great hush descended. He never had an organ. He called it the devil's whistle. He believed in singing unaccompanied. He said the vox humana, the human voice, is the most pure sound on earth. And it must have been something. They had a precentor with a tuning fork to hear 6,000 people singing unaccompanied the praise of God. To encourage his people to sing, Spurgeon produced a new hymn book, and you still buy a replica of it today. Here's his preaching desk that he had, and the one on the left is, I know from an earlier time, but it came with him, so he would just have his notes to one side with a clock. And he was a very mobile preacher. You may or may not have enjoyed his style as he moved around. There it is, his preaching desk under his left hand. And he was always trying to inform people that he wanted to tell the truth. So he often signed himself, "Yours very truly, C.H. Spurgeon." Here are his sermon notes. You can still buy originals if you want today, if you're into memorabilia of Spurgeon. It's just interesting to see the development of thought and how he crossed things out. He was great friends with many people, not least D.L. Moody. And if you go to the Moody Memorial Church in Chicago, if you go up the stairs to the little archive room, you'll see there the portable instrument that Sankey had. And Sankey came and sang for Spurgeon, actually sang at Spurgeon's funeral. And he was a great friend with Moody, although John Pollock, in his life of Moody, tells us that at one period he was fed up with Spurgeon, because Spurgeon liked to use everything to publicise himself. He would have been into iPads and everything today, I'm convinced of it. And Moody had set up some posters saying, you know, I'm having a revival rally in a certain part of London, and Spurgeon had his people come along and put posters over the top saying, "Come in here, Spurgeon." So he wasn't above upsetting people sometimes. But there we are. But it must have been an astonishing thing. Here is the tabernacle. In the front row, you'll see here people from the orphanage that he founded. They were given privileged positions. And over 14,600 people were received into membership during his pastorate there, which is, again, astonishing. Here is a group of pastors who he kept in touch with. There's Tom Medhurst. I mentioned him earlier. In later years, sadly, during one of the great controversies, he turned on Spurgeon and didn't follow him, but there we go. A bust of Spurgeon. People wanted to know what he looked like, so he said this was the most painful experience of his whole life. They stuck two tubes up his nostrils, told him to shut his eyes, and they covered his face for 2 hours with plaster and other things, so they got the contours just right. So all he had to stay there and just breathe through his nose, tempted to cough and blink and all the rest of it. He said, never again. But that's what he looked like. And if you go to Spurgeon's College, they've got a full-size statue of him. So it gives you an idea of this man. He was only 5'6" tall, so sometimes good things come in small packages. But incredible barrel chest. And then revival and godly literature. People wanted him to go into print. And so his sermons were produced. On a Monday, the transcript was delivered to him. He altered it. It was sent back. And by the Thursday, it was on the streets. January 1855, the first sermon in the Penny Pulpit was produced. 10th of May 1917, many years after his death, the last sermon was published 62 years later. And they only stopped publishing his sermons because of the shortage of paper due to the First World War. This was published on December the 14th, 1911, and still only cost a penny. So they kept the price the same. Now, a number of the sermons weren't published, so I'm really pleased that Terence Crosby has been working on this for day one. We've got 3 volumes here of sermons. Many of them have never been published before. So they are really worth reading, because as well as getting all the others that have been published. And that is the Pilgrim Publication Edition. The guy who runs Pilgrim, Mike Ross, very kindly sent me this, because when they started republishing them, he wanted everyone to know about it. And during the first Gulf War under the previous President Bush, With all these American troops going out, Pilgrim Publications had a great heart for the welfare of the soldiers. So they reprinted one of the penny pulpits. They sent thousands of copies out to Iraq. Many American troops read it, and they said it was an unbelievable sight to see. In so many places in Iraq, a makeshift baptistry being dug out of the sand, lined, and those American soldiers who had come to Christ through reading a Spurgeon sermon being baptized. He being dead yet speaketh. He did travel around. This is the Inn on the Green at Ockley, and he did stay in many pubs. But while he was at this one in Surrey, he wrote his most famous book, probably, John Plowman's Talk. And here he is, as he is depicted in many publications, the great preacher, and portrayed on the right-hand side there, it's the symbol, the apothecary symbol, really, but it's of Moses lifting up the serpent in the wilderness because he lifted up Jesus to draw all men to the Lord. Then revival and good works. He started a boys' orphanage in Stockwell. There's a secondary school on the site today, and Spurgeon wanted them to be kept safe. Oh, if only we'd followed him, maybe the kerfuffle of the past few years would have been lessened, it wouldn't have been stopped. He wanted them all to swim, something he never could do himself, and he was so proud that all the boys could swim, and he built there an Olympic-sized swimming pool that the school still used to this day. He also built a girls' orphanage. James Archer Spurgeon, one of the distant relatives of CHS, showing the plaque that's there to two boys, boy and a girl at Spurgeon's home. He also started a Culpepper Association. If any of you go to Beamish, did you know the museum? Well, if you go in, I can't remember which building it is, you'll see that box. That's the Spurgeon Culpepper Association box, where these men went round and about to sell good books, tracts and Bibles in the highways and the byways of England. And each year, Spurgeon would hold a Thanksgiving service for their work in the tabernacle, and he'd get one of the Culpeppers to come to the front and to describe the work. And one came one year, rather cheekily, and he said, "I've got a book to recommend to you, written by a good friend of mine called Charles Haddon Spurgeon." Now, Spurgeon sat about that far away. And the Culpepper describes how he goes to persuade people to buy this good work, and then he turns and he says, "This only costs 3 and 6 pence. Will you buy it?" And much to the delight of the congregation, Spurgeon put his hand in the pocket and bought his own book. But it was great work that was done. Also, just to give you an idea, he had such a heart for the welfare of people. It comes across so many sermons. He preached for the Aged Pilgrims Friends Society, the top one. Then was distress in Lancashire because the cotton mills were suffering because of the American Civil War. He preached about that. And then about the poverty of his day. And then about the Crimean War, and about those who had suffered. You'll see the penultimate one at the bottom there, A Voice from the Sea, which starts by referring to the sudden hurricane that hit London at 4 p.m. on Sunday the 24th of March, and 1878. And then he preached on a Thursday evening, we don't know when, Camp Law and Camp Life, during which he spoke on the need for bodily cleanliness, because he realised that many people followed the first Queen Elizabeth. You may know Queen Elizabeth I used to say, "I take a bath once a year, whether I need it or not." Well, many people followed that. But also, Jack the Ripper, 1888. There were these awful murders from August to November 1888. Near Whitechapel, not all in Whitechapel, in February 1888, my grandfather was born in Whitechapel. I do not blame him for the murders. But he said, as a young boy, his mother used to send him off to go and work in pawnbroker's shops, so he slept at night under the counter as a 4, 5, 6-year-old boy. He was told last thing at night, "If you're not a good boy, Jack will get you." And these awful murders. Jack the Ripper was coined by a journalist. Jack is one of those awful names in English history. Jack Ketch was one of the Queen's executioners back in Tudor times. He often botched executions. Then there was a spring-heeled Jack, somebody who also in medieval times had come round terrorising people. And there was the red-legged Jack, someone who appeared like a demon and frightened women at night. So the name Jack was a terrifying name to Londoners. And when these appalling murders were taking place, that is why he was called Jack the Ripper, and not any other name, to emphasise the appalling nature. Well, the 30th of September 1888, it was the night of the double murder. And it's when Liz Stride had been attacked, she was bleeding to death, when a horse and cart turned up, and they think that Jack was disturbed in his awful work. Less than an hour later, in Mitre Square off Leadenhall Street, very near St Helen's Bishopsgate, Catherine Eddowes was discovered, literally ripped apart like a pig. If you really desire, you can see the original photographs online. And that her body was discovered at 1:15 in the morning. By 11 o'clock in the morning, without any electronic devices, news had spread throughout London, and Spurgeon in his pastoral prayer referred to the double murder and said, "O Lord, stop this evil amongst us." So he was ready, whenever anything was happening, to respond to it. Then revival and opposition. This is one of his houses he had in a place called Clapham, Hellingsburg House. And he on more than one occasion, tells people that he paid for his own property out of the sale of his sermons. I think he needed to do that because people were becoming concerned that he was having a very opulent lifestyle. Eventually, he moved to Upper Norwood, to a place called Westwood. There's a girls' school there now, and the outline of the school mimics his mansion that he had there. It's down Spurgeon Road. And he had such things that all pastors desire, like a pond with a boat on it, a butler, staff. I tell my church this, I'm a pastor of a church, and they don't listen. But there we go. And he also had this wonderful carriage with these two horses on. The Archbishop of Canterbury himself said that Spurgeon's horses were the finest in London. So whenever they were free, he asked Spurgeon if he could use them on state occasions. Now, he used to go from Westwood down to the Elephant and Castle. It's quite a little distance down through West Norwood today, out. He may have gone via Brixton or over Denmark Hill, if you know that part of the world, to the Tabernacle. And there were some people who criticised him. "How dare you make your animals work on the Lord's Day?" Well, he always had an answer, did Spurge. He said, "Oh, but don't you know? My horses are Jews, so they have Saturday off." Top right, you'll see Austin Henry Layard, the rediscoverer of Nineveh. Notice it's Nineveh and not Nineveh, if ever you read Jonah or Nahum. The rediscoverer of Nineveh. At the bottom left, you'll see a reconstructed gateway of Nineveh, constructed by Saddam Hussein, using such ancient materials as breeze blocks, which has not pleased archaeologists. But anyway, Layard was a great friend of Spurgeon. And Darwinism and evolution came during this whole period. And Spurgeon gave a lecture on the gorilla. And Layard chaired the meeting. And critics said afterwards, "Well, if evolution's true, in about 3 million years' time, we shall have a gorilla giving a lecture on Spurgeon." So that's what you see there. And all the others there chiming in. But the biggest problem was that was called the downgrade controversy, that the church were downgrading the gospel, downgrading the scriptures, not just because of evolution, but many other things. Robert Schindler wrote two articles, the first one published in Spurgeon's magazine that he started, The Sword and the Trowel, in 1887. And this is what he said: "We are going downhill at breakneck speed. We are leaving the Bible far behind. I wonder what he would say if he was with us today." And in it, these were the issues at stake. People derided the inspiration of the Bible. It's just a collection of old documents. People diminished the atonement of Jesus Christ. It's nothing new, you know. There are many ways to God. They thought Jesus' resurrection from the dead was a myth. They considered the Holy Spirit to be a farce and punishment for sin in this life and after death. Well, that's a fiction, isn't it? And Spurgeon had to make a stand. Sadly, his brother, misinterpreting what was going on, his co-pastor at the Tabernacle, when he was censored by the Baptist Union, his brother stood against him. As did others we have seen, like Tom Medhurst. And humanly speaking, people think this shortened his life. This happened in 1887 through 1888. Isn't it interesting when Jack the Ripper as well? So you see all the social evils. And Spurgeon died eventually in 1892. And so all these cartoons started to come out. The caricature on the right-hand side. On the left, if you look carefully, you will notice there's none of the upper echelons of society there. It's only the riffraff and the drags of society. He can't attract them. Little did they know, or little did they care, that the Prime Minister, William Gladstone, was often seen just behind the pulpit at an act of worship. And Gladstone actually walked from Downing Street all the way to the Tabernacle on more than one occasion to listen to Spurgeon. He invited Spurgeon in for a meal, and it only happened once. He went back to Downing Street. The newspapers got wind of this, and the title was, "The Two Prime Ministers of England Have Tea." Because Spurgeon was the Prime Minister, without a doubt. And so he was attacked in many ways. He also had problems with his smoking. And here he is on a player's cigarette card. Because he was told that, you know, to get rid of coughs and colds, you smoke. That's obvious, isn't it? He was a man of his day before we censor him too much. "When I have found intense pain relieved, a weary brain soothed, and calm, refreshing sleep obtained by a cigar, I have felt grateful to God and have blessed his name." So there you are. He's number, whatever it is, number 20 in the series of 20. So he's right at the end. Indeed, one lady got so angry with him over smoking, she said, remember, he was a man of his day, so zips hadn't been invented. She said, "Mr. Spurgeon, if God had meant you to smoke, you would have been born with a chimney on your head." "Yes, madam," he said, "and if God had meant me to wear trousers, I would have been born with buttons on my stomach." But there we go. Here we see a Jubilee reverie for the Her Majesty Queen Victoria. You will see very many famous people, Isambard Kingdom, Brunel, Charles Darwin, and the top right, Spurgeon. So he was loved by many people, despite all the problems. Because of his health issues, he used to go to Menton in the south of France. Again, people misunderstood him in this, going down to the Swanee and around the south of France when everyone else was suffering back in England. But that is what happened, and he loved this place, and he spent a lot of time there. Here's the Hotel Beau Rivage. It is no longer in existence. You'll see there that little balcony, and that is his room, and just round to the right, which is off my picture, is his bedroom. And when, in his last illness, he was lying there suffering, one of his secretaries, Joseph Harold, was convinced to his dying day that as he looked out of a window from the hotel there, he saw angels hovering. And he said it looked like they were waiting for someone. And he rushed off and he got Mrs. Spurgeon. He said, "Come, look, look, look." But she couldn't see anything. Well, it didn't take long for Spurgeon to pass away. Not because of his drinking, just because of the way he was. He died of gout and also Bright's disease, which is a disease of the kidneys. And he was taken immediately to the cemetery at Menton, where he was embalmed under French law, put in a lead-lined coffin. And then he would be transported back to this country. Mrs. Spurgeon was so distraught, she decided not to come home for the funeral and stayed there. One of his twin sons, Thomas, was a minister in New Zealand. He was actually in Australia when he heard, and he couldn't get back for the funeral in time. In those days, you had to come by sea and not by air. And so his mother sent him a telegram: "Father dead, mother resigned." And his body was brought eventually to Victoria Station. If you go to Victoria Station today, you'll see that plaque on the wall. That was a veteran who's no longer alive from the First World War at Platform 8. And Spurgeon's body arrived at Platform 3. And you can actually go and stand on Platform 3 today. And you can imagine the coffin coming off, being put on a carriage and driven down past Westminster Abbey, the Houses of Parliament, over the river, to the Tabernacle. at the Elephant and Castle. His son had started the work in Auckland, that's the Baptist Tabernacle in Auckland, similar frontage to the tabernacle here in England. And he was very upset he couldn't come back for Dad's funeral. His coffin lay in state for many days, and many people passed by it. It was a most moving occasion, people said. The Christian Herald recorded it in this way, with a portrait of him on the right, with some of his institutions, and then on the left, you will see different scenes from his funeral. They reckon that it was the largest number of people attended his funeral until Diana, Princess of Wales' funeral in London. I don't know how you assess these things, but there we are. And eventually it made this long journey, and this is the second edition of the book, and I found the actual route, so you can, we've marked it out in the back if any of you are interested. The long journey to Norwood Cemetery, and the gateway that is there is still there to this day. And I used to take many funerals in that cemetery and have passed through that gate very often, and I always used to think of CHS when I was there. King's College, Cambridge. You may think this is a diversion, but it's not, because Spurgeon didn't want a big mausoleum. All he wanted was a little plaque on the ground. And people have said, why is that? When Spurgeon was in Cambridge, no doubt he would have gone into King's College, and in there he would have, this is in the university, the bust of the famous Charles Simeon. Incidentally, Derek Prime has written a wonderful book on Simeon for Day One Publications. We think it might be Derek's last published work, so if you know him, buy it. It's brilliant. But anyway, in King's College Chapel, there is Simeon's grave, CS, 1836. It's just near the west doors. But he was given a more elaborate funeral than he wanted. Many, many people came. He had this wonderful ability to stand foursquare for the truth, but to embrace all humanity. So when he was dying, even the chief rabbi of Great Britain was praying for him. And there were many people who came and took part, including the Bishop of Rochester here, pronouncing the benediction. And there is the coffin being laid to rest. My father, during the Second World War, the crematorium was bombed. The front of Spurgeon's tomb came open. My dad saw that, and the palm branch that they had laid on there was still in place. There you get the great bust on the front there with the words, I have fought the good fight, the Bible text. At the side there, the grills are not in place anymore. So I've said to my wife, if I predecease her, could she have me cremated and on a quiet day go and pour my ashes on top of Spurgeon? So on the day of resurrection, we can go up together and he'll look and go, who are you? Oh, yeah. But forgive me for that. But you'll see it here, and it's wonderful. And you can see the bomb damage on the door at the front there. And it stands as a testimony to the gospel. Because to this day, many Hindus have their last funeral services, last rites at this crematorium. And they come with their prayers, and they walk, and they stop with the coffin, and you can watch them, and they pray whatever they pray, and then they walk a few more steps. And all the time, Spurgeon is just there, almost passively, and speaking to them. The actual words, which I find so inspiring, the people read, whether they want to or not, "Ere since by faith I saw the stream, thy flowing wounds supply, redeeming love has been my theme, and shall be till I die. Then in a nobler, sweeter song I'll sing thy power to save, when this poor lisping, stammering tongue lies silent in the grave." And to this day, thousands of people each year pass by and read those words. There it lies. You can see the entrance that goes up. He's just over to the left there, so you can see something of it. A portrait, a very fine portrait of Spurgeon, in Earl's Colne Baptist Church. Revival. A people saturated with God, who are motivated with love for God, praying to God, worshipping God, and then passionate and unusually effective in evangelism. At one of the Spurgeon's Jubilee services, one of his secretaries read out all the societies he'd started and he still supported, and there were 66 of them, including the orphanages and everything else. I don't know anybody else quite like him from history. I think he is unique. "Look unto me and be ye saved, all the ends of the earth." That was his passion. I wonder, is it our passion, dear friends? I want to finish, if I can just take one more moment, with the words of Archibald Brown. I find these most moving. With just a very slight adjustment, I use these at the funeral of my mother, because I think they're so powerful. You can imagine there at the cemetery, these thousands of people, and the pastor of the East London Tabernacle stands up, a former student of the college, and he says this of Spurgeon. Beloved President, faithful pastor, prince of preachers, brother beloved, dear Spurgeon, we bid thee not farewell, but only for a little while, good night. Thou shalt rise soon at the first dawn of the resurrection day of the redeemed. Yet is not the good night ours to bid, but thine. It is we who linger in the darkness. Thou art in God's holy light. Here for a little while shall rest thy precious dust. Then shalt thy well-beloved come, and at his voice thou shalt spring from thy couch of earth, fashioned like unto his body into glory. Then spirit, soul, and body shall magnify the Lord's redemption. Until then, beloved, sleep. And I really love these words. We praise God for thee, and by the blood of the everlasting covenant, hope and expect to praise God with thee. May that be our testimony. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much indeed, Clive, for that very full talk. I'm sure we've all learned a great deal.
Clive, I just want to thank you ever so much. I was quite overwhelmed with your passion. You obviously see you really love Spurgeon. Your dedication to detail, I thought, was great. I was just very moved, so thank you personally. My question is, obviously, because you've studied Spurgeon in quite great detail, he's done so much, he's a hero of mine, and what do you think has impacted your ministry that you can probably contrast from his? Because obviously you can't but study a person and something rubs off. It's like looking at a person and it's a glint in the eye. It's not something you can learn, it's something that's imparted. So if I could ask you that question, what do you think's really rubbed off the most for you?
Thank you. It's two things. Spurgeon was asked, what was the human secret of his success? He said, my people pray for me. And it must have been quite something. I don't know how they used to run it, but there would be over 2,000 people at the prayer meeting on a Monday night in the tabernacle. And the second thing he said, and more importantly, is it's all of God, the Holy Spirit. And so the things that have rubbed off on me is to try and call people to prayer, but also that we're totally reliant on God. Whatever gifts he gives us, thank God for them, but we can only do so much. And so it's the work of the Holy Spirit and prayer.
Thank you for the presentation, that from a former member of Westminster Chapel under Lloyd Jones, I might say, yes. Even older than you are, Clive.
Surely not.
There seem to be two really approaches to persistent, blatant heresy within one's church. Now, one's reflected by Spurgeon in his approach to it, and we've seen that in St. George's Tron in Edinburgh in recent days. The other is by, say, Gresham Matron in the United States, where he exposed and fought against it, but stayed in until they kicked him out. Mm. And I just wonder if you would like to comment on those two approaches, because it is a fact. I'm a member of an Evangelical Baptist Church, which is a member of the Baptist Union. There are many, you know, there are different ways of going about this.
Yes, because Lloyd Jones is my other great hero. 1966, with what took place with John Stott in the Central Hall in Westminster, where Stott just got up, and I think he probably did it very graciously, knowing John, just said he disagreed with Lloyd Jones' call, as he perceived it, for all evangelicals to come out of their denominations and meet together. I really think there's no easy answer to this, either in Spurgeon's day or in our day. I think you really do need to be on your knees before God about it. And I think in some instances you do stay in, and others you come out. Now, I belong to a church that is a member of the FIEC, the Fellowship of Independent Evangelical Churches, but I've got many friends who are in regular denominations, who are fine Christians, and feel it is right they stay there. And I think it is something between you and God. I don't think there's an easy answer to this one, because we live in a fallen world and we're all sinners, aren't we? And God is able to use us where we are. But if we can call people back to prayer and can cry out for the Holy Spirit to come in revival upon us, who knows what may happen? And so I'm sorry, I'm going to sit on the fence because it's too difficult for someone with my lack of brain power.
Can you tell us more about the way that Spurgeon went about addressing the downgrade controversy? Was it simply in his preaching, or did he do more to try and tackle the problem as he saw it?
Yes, he did it through his preaching, through his writing. He did it by trying to get people together. He discussed it each year at the pastor's college. They would have a conference, and so they discussed it, but it was only for 3 years before he passed away. And he sought to engage with people. I don't know how he did it. He could say, we profoundly disagree. He could really go hammer and tongs at you, but somehow you'd still end up as friends. So it was always the issues that were at stake, not the personalities with him. And so he sought to always maintain friendship with all. One of his most famous sermons, and it sold millions of copies eventually, was the baptismal regeneration controversy, where he preached against what the Church of England, many in the Church of England, were doing in his day, that the infants who were baptised were immediately in Christ's kingdom. And he was able to do that, but as you saw, who was given the benediction at his funeral? The Bishop of Rochester. So it was that wonderful ability of separating the issue but maintaining the friendship with people. And he sought to do that, but it was only for just on 3 years before he was taken seriously ill. So it would have been interesting if he had lived to see what would have happened.
Spurgeon was clearly a great preacher. Could you say a little more about his pastoral work, not least with such vast congregations and membership roles?
Yes, again, it's almost unbelievable. He interviewed everybody who wanted to become a member of his church, and he knew them all by name. And if anyone was in need, he always carried with him, which was a lot of money in those days, rolled up £5 notes in his waistcoat pocket. And if he heard if anyone was in need, he would just quietly go up to them and say, "That's for you." Or he would go round to their house deliberately with the equivalent of the envelope from CHS for you to spend on yourself. And if he heard anyone was sick, he would go and pray with them. I don't know how he fitted it all in, but he had this incredible capacity. I mentioned him earlier, some of you may have known Derek Prime. I think he's the nearest I know to a Spurgeon pastorally. Derek Prime has never forgotten the face. I stood next to him at church one day, and someone he hadn't seen for 30 years walked in, and Derek said, "Oh, hello," whatever his name was, George Bert Fred. And he knew all about that man. And so there are some people who have this God-given ability. And in Spurgeon, it was combined, and it was unique. He also had a wonderful team around him, his deacons. He said his deacons were the most important people in the church because they ensured that it ran smoothly, because the great tabernacle was used 7 days a week. It was used for educating the poor, for feeding the poor, for all sorts of other things, but also that people could come and pray. As soon as he heard from one of the deacons or one of the elders that someone was in need, he was there. So he wore himself out. And he was always intimately interested in everybody. I only pastor a church of about 90 people, and I get exhausted. I don't know how he did it with 6,000. But somehow he did. And I commend it to you if you get any of Spurgeon's books. Look at his pastoral skills.
I remember reading about his gift for speed reading and his sermon preparation, Saturday night, 6 o'clock, through Saturday night, Sunday morning, 6 sermons at a time. Can you confirm that?
Yes, I can. He had, again, it's another enviable gift. He could read a book in one go, and he could virtually memorise everything. So you could go into his study of several thousand, about 10,000 books. You could pull a book off the shelf. If he'd read it, you could open it and you could go, whatever it is, page 558. What's top right? And he would tell you. He had this photographic memory. And so for him, After tea time on a Saturday, it wasn't watching the football results when Spurs always are shown as losing, but it was for him, whoever was there, he said, now it's time to prepare. And he would dedicate himself to it, but he read so much that all of his reading through the week sort of came out supremely gifted. Sunday afternoons he was often seen, because it was too far to come back home on a Sunday afternoon, in someone's home. He'd get a scrap piece of paper and write his sermon notes out. Except one Sunday, one Saturday, he was really struggling. And he didn't know what God wanted him to do. He often produced, as you say, 6 or 7 sermon outlines. But if he didn't feel they were right, he discarded them. I often wonder what they were like. And he went to bed and he said to his wife, wake me up early, because I need to get food ready for my chickens tomorrow. And she said it was astonishing. About 2 o'clock in the morning, she heard him turn over and start speaking. And she realized that he was speaking his sermon. So somehow she found a bit of paper and she wrote it all down. He was fast a kip. The next morning he wakes up, she woke him up, and he said, you were supposed to wake me up early. She said, don't bother, my dear, look at this. And he went, wow, thank you, and went off and preached it. So it was this incredible ability that God had given him, with this fantastic memory and the ability to organise it. Now, he wasn't always the best preacher. If you stuck him in a sermon class, he would fail sometimes. You wonder, well, how does he get that out of the text? Because he's not referred to the text at all. But he genuinely had this heart for God, and more times than not, he did produce vast amounts, and he did it that way. I don't recommend it, by the way, chaps, if any of you are preachers here. Do it during the week. It's a lot easier.
Can you say something about his family? I think you mentioned a son who was in New Zealand, and how much time he was able to devote to family life.
Yes, thank you. He had twin sons. After his sons were born, his wife developed some form of gynecological problem. She was operated on by Sir James Simpson, who was a famous surgeon at the time, and he would never accept a fee from Spurgeon, because you had to pay in those days for these things. And Spurgeon said, it's only right I pay you for helping my wife. And he said, I'll tell you what, you can pay me, Spurgeon, when you become Archbishop of Canterbury. But his wife suffered appallingly. I think today, with medical science, they could have cured her quite easily. She was called an invalid because of whatever it was. I know the wonderful story in the Gospels about the woman with the issue of blood resonated with her very keenly, and she often longed for healing. His boys followed him into the ministry. Thomas and Charles, it's unfortunate they call one of them Charles, because that's very confusing, 2 Charles Spurgeons. Thomas was the better preacher, and they did preach. Thomas became pastor of the Tabernacle for a period after his father had died, but they just sort of just drifted away, really. Charles is buried next to his father, just on the opposite side of the path at the cemetery, but you won't see it because there's no marker there. Some of us fought very hard a few years ago. Lambeth, who are the borough council that the cemetery comes under, wanted to raise all the tombs to make them flat. So it became like a park-like area so that young people wouldn't be afraid going to a cemetery. And we said, you can't destroy Spurgeon's and all these others, you know, that were there. My father actually persuaded a local undertaker, free of charge, to go in and repaint those words, "There since by faith." In black, so they need doing again now, but Dad's long in glory. But there is this great heritage of his. So there's Spurgeon family all over the country now, but there's none quite like him. I don't know if they're related to him in East Anglia, but I came across a wonderful butcher's shop in Norwich that belonged to the family Spurgeon. And it said next to them, "Quality meats here." And I thought, yes, that sums him up, doesn't it?
You can't help but read Spurgeon, and something that comes up through most of his sermons is his ability to paint a landscape, but obviously bring in the spiritual climate of a nation or the location or sin at the time. Grace and law, he always, the books and commentaries I've looked at on the sword and trial, he would always draw reference and make statements like, really, don't want to get into a downgrade of truth and upgrade of error, but he would really paint a vivid picture that you can't dispense a cheap grace. Mm. It really has to be a law first to break up the ground. My question, of course, is some do and some don't today. If the Ten Commandments, which obviously have been removed, I used to lecture in prison, so I've worked with a gamut of lots of different people. And when we got onto Diversity Week, I would always take the opportunity, we'd talk different faiths and what have you. So I would always bring in the commandments because always to prick the conscience and point them to the Saviour. It's a great controversial debate. Just curious how you handle it in your ministry today, or if you hear perhaps a grace that is being dispensed, but really it's going to fall on deaf ears. Is that okay?
Yes, indeed.
Thanks.
Thomas Watson, the Puritan, said that God speaks through two lips, the Old and the New Testament, and I don't think you can separate them, and you have to have the law. And it's, you don't understand what Jesus has done without the Old Testament. And yeah, and Spurgeon sometimes does go a little bit too much law work. I think that's because of the influence of the Puritans. Some of them do. They you know, some, you know, brilliant writers, but some of them just go on and on and on. And you think, I want to get off this train. But yeah, you've got to have a balance. If I can just give you my testimony, I grew up in a Christian family, but the law meant nothing to me. I was only about 14 years of age. I think this is when I was converted, I'm not sure. But my grandfather, who I alluded to earlier, he passed away. They had his funeral in our church, and he went up to West Norwood Crematorium. But Grandad's favourite word was the word redeemed. And we had a sign writer in the church at that time. And so my father and his brother had the word redeemed written twice, big red letters on a white background, pinned either side of the coffin. And I don't think I'll ever forget it, seeing the coffin come down that long aisle with the word redeemed. Grandad at the front with the word redeemed, going out with the word redeemed. And as a 14-year-old, I thought, nothing to do with the law, I thought, if Clive was in there instead of Grandad, would anyone write redeemed over me? And it really challenged me. I think, yeah, the law from that I'd learnt as well, but I think it's essential, honestly. Maybe I'm a dinosaur, but if only we use the Ten Commandments more today. Just one other thing, if I can. In my church, rightly or wrongly, every Sunday morning now, we say the Lord's Prayer. I know we do it by rote. I was challenged by a friend of mine. He said, Clive, why don't you use the Lord's Prayer every Sunday in your church? I said, well, we used to do that when I grew up. And he said, do it today. I said to him, I said, Peter, why? He said, because when you went to school, you said it every day. Your kids in church don't say it at all now at school. And it's astonishing. You know, it sometimes there's tears in my eyes. We've got a little three-year-old. And I have to look at him as he's doing it. Ah, Father! You know, and it's brilliant. And we do that occasionally also. We read out the Ten Commandments. Because again, you know, when are people going to learn them? Just something I'll give you.
Thank you very much indeed. Once again, your talk and for the way you answered those questions, and we are deeply grateful to you.